evaluating and considering the very useful inputs from captains of industry, government, and other interest groups. And it is our intention to for promulgation during September, and depending on the Minister of Finance's engagement on this, would hopefully promulgate this in October. Many of these practical issues, which I am very thankful that was submitted to us, we hope to incorporate into the revised SA regulations. There's a huge amount of opportunity just to latch on to the presentation from Science and Technology, if I may, Chairperson, where the localization really gives an opportunity to optimize when we look at so-called recurring procurement. Medicine is consumed, and forever we will keep on buying those commodities to the tune of 50 billion rand a year, which we should not underestimate. I think the industrialization program and the evidence that was put before this committee is fantastic, but it's one-off investments that will be sustained only by the quality of marketing campaigns to either export or make these technologies such as locomotives available in other markets. You can only buy so many locomotives in the domestic market. But medicines, bandages, syringes, agri-processed stuff, foodstuff in our schools, hospitals, we will buy on a continuous basis, and this is maybe an opportunity where we can really maximize buying local and doing that in a sustainable way. Chairperson, I think this is the concluding remarks on cost and maybe the PPPA regulations as well, how we can make this a little bit more sustainable.
Thank you very much, Mr. Hewitt. Is that right? Thank you. And of course, we may well come back to you, but I just want to get an intervention here from the DDG Strachan, that is from trade and industry. Over to you, DDG.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My colleague, Sandy Pele, who's in charge of rail and foundries, and Dr. Makube will come in to support me where I go wrong or where they need to add. Not necessarily in the order of the questions. The issue of foundries is a huge problem. I think we've lost probably half of our foundries. We used to have over 400. Now I'm informed by Tandipele below 200. The double-digit increases in electricity year on year is the principal reason for that. It's not about access to iron ore, it's access to scrap metal, which gets back to the discussion we had over the last few days, which is why ITAC have put in place measures to encumber the unencumbered export of scrap metal, and which is the reason why we asked an export tax on scrap metal in 2010, if not 2009, and we're still sitting in a situation where, to the best of our knowledge, the ITAC measures on scrap metal exports are having very limited, if any, impact, and why the DTI, and I say this mindful of the fact that the National Treasury is responsible for taxes, from where we sit, we would like to see an export on scrap metal, which would be an enormous benefit for the scrap metal, the mini mills and the foundries. The second question, which came from the Honourable Mbongi, I think deals with indigenous knowledge and products, and this committee has dealt with that before, and the form falls under the intellectual property issues, and so, especially since I'm not an expert on this, I'll defer on it. Import substitution refers to a theoretical construct for in development economics. It's not a program set up in either the National Industrial Policy Framework or the Industrial Policy Action Plan. But import substitution lies at the heart of much of what we do, because it's to try and we are an economy which has financialized. The financial sector is growing at twice the rate of the production sectors of the economy. We are import intensive and credit fueled growth, and a very dangerous and unless we deploy a set of measures which would include strategic tariff deployment, support for the manufacturing sector through incentives and industrial financing and procurement, we won't get import substitution. We will simply see what we've seen for the last decade, which is input intensity and with all the consequences that flow from that, which is include the balance of trade. I have to say that I'm not absolutely in agreement with my colleagues from the National Treasury. A recurring procurement in agro-processing and health is absolutely important. But you're not going to build industrial capabilities in agro-processing and pharmaceuticals, which is not labor-intensive, by the way, alone. We have to build industrial capabilities, amongst other things, in rail. And we agree absolutely that the procurement instrument should be used with the supply development instrument to rebuild our capabilities in rail and then ensure that both OEMs and supplier development companies have the capabilities to export and enter into global supply chains. And the African market represents an important opportunity both for exports and regional industrial integration in rail and associated infrastructure. Madam Chair, the issue of verification, whether or not the bidder or the state pays for the verification, the state will bear the cost because the bidder will put the price of the verification into the bid. And so I think we must perhaps get out of a space that actually it's either private sector or public sector cost. It's not. It'll accrue to the state because the state is the procuring entity in this case. I also completely agree, and I said this yesterday and the day before, that we've got to not put a huge regulatory burden on the private sector. In some countries, you have to procure local. If you don't procure local, you face sometimes highly prejudicial compliance measures, such as are contained in the Buy America Act. But we do have to have some compliance measures. I think the SAS verification is absolutely critical, and we've got to ensure that this matter is sorted out. And from a DTI perspective, we believe it has to be enshrined in the legislation and the regulation. And it appears, or it isn't, so enshrined at the moment. But I think we also, as I said yesterday, have to have a combination of other measures which need to be discussed, which is declarations, audits, one strike and you're out. If you falsely declare and you're caught out, you can no longer bid for public procurement and so on and so forth. And that's a complicated discussion about a set of measures which don't add a high regulatory burden to the private sector, but ensure that compliance is achieved and that the cost of compliance isn't a big additional cost to the fiscus. I think the critical question that we at the DTI would say is, in circumstances where there's only 4.5% verification, we've got to get a move on and ensure that actually the measures with minimal regulation and cost to the state are put in place urgently and support localization and supplier development. As I also said, there's confusion between procurement and supplier development. Madam Chair, I want to end there and ask perhaps my colleague Dr. Makube to add where he...
Thanks, and good morning to members. Maybe just to contextualize the numbers from the Bureau of Standards, in particular the 4.5% verification. The challenge there in the main is that successful bidders are refusing to pay for the verification because they are saying that there's no requirement for them to pay for verification. So we have to deal with that. You know, we've been requesting that we amend the bidding condition, the bidding documents, so that we make the cost of verification a requirement upfront. You know, so when we receive the documents, then the Bureau of Standards cannot come up with its own cost. You know, a bidder will have to then pay what is reflected in the bidding document. So I agree with the DTG that the debate should move on as to who bears the cost, because at the end it is the business whether you get it via a private individual or a procuring entity. The net effect is that the cost remains with the business. And also in developing this methodology, the bigger picture should not be on the financial impact in terms of monetary terms. I think what the Department of Science and Technology is presenting shows that this is a feedback loop. You know, it's reinforcing itself, because if you look at what is coming back through tax, also has an impact in terms of the revenue base of the country increases. So, and we know the net effect of that, that therefore the social wage will decrease in the long term if the revenue base is increasing and people are get the opportunity to be employed in the economy. And that is the bigger picture. So you need a verification process so that then there is a positive net effect and spillover in the economy through local production. And that is the main reason why we are supporting local procurement. Thank you.
Dr. Makube, yes, ma'am. I know you're probably here. Thanks, Chair. My name is Tali Pele. I'm Chief Director responsible for metal fabrication, rail, and capital equipment sector that within the industrial development division of the DTI. I just wanted to add a couple of points on the questions that the Honorable Nkongi asked on the primary industry. I think just to add on the point that the DDG has already added, that the primary industry is under tremendous amount of pressure. From a cost point of view, I think it has already indicated the issues of administrative costs or administrative pricing, particularly electricity and transport logistics. Issues about access to quality of scrap at the right competitive price is a really big challenge for our foundry industry. And I think also the issue about most of the industry is still doing jobbing production. Jobbing, you know, they're doing orders as and when they have an order book. You know, the issue about economies of scale is something that really need to, we need to really look at how do we increase the market for our casting products, and hence for the conversation of the debate that is taking place today in the House on localization. If we look at what we've already done in the DCI, we've indicated in the rolling stock instruction notes that all castings and forging products that go into any type of rolling stock ought to be procured locally in order to sustain our foundry industry. Similarly, in the products that are casting intensive, for example, valves, we have got a clause in our instruction note that says, in you discharging the local content requirements, we must ensure that the castings are also produced locally. So going forward, as we look at opportunities for localization, we are also looking at areas where we can increase local production of castings. We are looking at designation of pumps, which is another area that is very casting intensive, that we are creating a demand for our casting industry. But also coupled with that is that there's also issues from an industry point of view that also need to be dealt with. The issues about quality, the issues about innovation and product development. It's issues that the industry on its own also have to deal with. But from the data point of view, working together with the Technology Localization Unit, we have a program in the CSIR called the National Foundry Technology Network to deal with some of the quality product development issues that the foundry industry is facing. That we, at the end of the day, we need to have, as I indicated yesterday, it's a balance between the supply and the demand side measures that is going to help us sustain our subsectors. And for us, as the DDG has already indicated, if we were to be able to deal with the issues of scrap, retention of our scrap as an input, a key input in the foundry industry, secondly, to deal with the exorbitant increases in the electricity costs, as you know, that the two inputs, electricity and scrap, constitute more than 60% of production costs in the foundry industry. So if we really have to make an impact in improving the competitiveness of our foundry industry, we need to deal with those two input materials. Thanks.
This has been very valuable. We still have one or two comments, questions from members. So let me just take this. Honourable Williams, Honourable Mkongi.
Thank you. Chair, I want to talk particularly to the question of who pays for verification. Now, we've heard from DTI, we've heard from Treasury and from SAS, they're telling us different things. So now, wouldn't it be, I want to know what this committee can do to assist so that we can finalize this, who pays for this verification. Because it seems to me it's just going to go on and on and on. There must be some mechanism in place so that we can finalize this once and for all. And I'd like to know what it is that this committee can do to assist that process. Thank you.
Williams, Honourable Mkongi.
No, thank you very much. I think that is what I wanted to enter. That what this committee, we are not because, but that is our responsibility. And if that law was passed without a proper consultation with other affected stakeholders in Parliament, therefore, we need to tap on that and make sure how do we reverse that and make sure the law comes. For example, the PPPFA, I never discussed that thing with Treasure. I was in this committee, I've been here. I don't remember our input in that. And these are the issues that we need to correct and make sure that we deal with them. Also, because if you look at the Mineral Resource Development Act, we have put our input there and then make sure that we deal with it. So even other committees and departments must be able to recognize that any law also implicates to other law that is in this country. That's the first one. The second one is the question of this thing of tender. I was checking here because of my township in this, what is a tender? It's telling me what is a tender. Now you give a person a tender and then you sign bidding and then you want verification. I don't have given everything to a person. I mean, it doesn't make any sense. It doesn't make any sense quality because this definition here is telling about quality of work, of the capacity of that person. And that is what part of verification that we can include localization and local content within that particular process. Why are we taking localization outside of the main issue? That are supposed to be part and parcel of what quality is. Because if we're talking about local content, we're talking about the quality of that particular product to reflect what we have as a country. So it makes sense to me. So it was very important that we enter this debate, shall I say, with the portfolio committee on finance, and then we clarify these issues that we need to reverse this will and make sure that we enter the debate of legislation on this particular matter and make sure that we are part and parcel of it. Because why I'm raising this, well, bring my shoes outside. Political will is that the politicians that are here. And that thing does not come to administrators whether there is administrative bill to implement the policies. They speak about political will, so it questions us as MPs, whether of PM. So we have a political will that localization must be successful. So therefore that policy or legislation must come back to us and then we must discuss it. Yeah, no, thank you very much, Mr. Chairperson.
You know, I want to just point out the CCCFA, preferential public procurement, financial act, wasn't enacted at the time, or rather localization came after. So obviously there would have been a slippage in the alignment. And we need National Treasury, it has acknowledged this, and I believe they are, thinking of amending aspects of the CCCFA so that it takes these anomalies into account. But the other thing, we all know, those of us in the administration, bureaucracy and politicians, every law that is brought before this parliament makes it very clear there's a question there. What are the financial implications? Am I right? So I think when localization, for example, went to the cabinet, it didn't just fly into parliament, it went to cabinet. It's a collective decision where all the ministers sit. How does this, only now is this now a crisis, and it is a crisis, it is. It's not, it's who pays. The reality is someone has to pay. The policy is localization. We know clearly why. And we need to stop arguing about that. We need to deal with the legislation. I want to acknowledge, Mr. Human, it is complex. So let us acknowledge that. We know it's not simple. But how long has localization been on the table? Wasn't it just this year? I think National Treasury and DTI have had some time to get to grips with this while acknowledging the complexities. Now, I think almost every law that comes before Parliament is complex. Look at the copyright. Are we now going to say too complex to put the legislation? No. We're going to unpack it. So my appeal, and we will write to National Treasury as well to underline this, is really for this to be accelerated. To our own minister, we're going to appeal, DDG Starkin, for a closer engagement with the National Treasury. We're also looking at the Department of Science and Technology. After all, it affects you. It affects CSIR. Who doesn't it affect? Any hands up? It affects all of us if we are either MPs or working in government or the entities. So I want us now, I don't want us to come back here and just say, who pays? Who pays? I mean, this is not a joke. We're not as far as shops. All right. So at this point in time, it's such a critical point, and that's why, for me, it's quite distressing to lose our whip at such a critical point in time, but we are glad you've offered your services here, Honourable Kalako, to step in every now and again. We're going to close this point of the session. We've got some tea, and I understand, and I'm looking at you, Mr. Whittington, you've been able to dredge up a few bottles of water so that those making presentations won't dry out. All right. So, but let us all consider our neighbours and take one cup of tea, one bottle. Thank you very much. So, Sam, do you want to come in there? Is that on the water we've got?
No, Chair. It's a queries that the committee raised on slide 16 of the transmit presentation. I just want to highlight here that the SABS will respond to that in writing to the committee.
Our practice, as the secretary knows, Mr. Medema, is we will also note to you, in case it's been quite a tough session, the issues that you do need to come back to us. But I do appreciate you making these notes yourself. May I indicate, this is all in your heads, or it's in your filing cabinet or the computer. So I see no reason why I couldn't be here on Monday. The issue really don't know.
It will be with you, Chair.
Right, thank you. Thank you. Thank you. We're breaking for 10 minutes. Thank you.
Did anyone see God, Mr. Strachan?
Oh, 那我就可以了，那你先搞一个，我不搞这个我就搞，像一个。 Now, were people sharing their bottles of water? We've taken a bit of time to get back. Mr. Winnington? That is right. If we can all just take our seats. And I must thank National Treasury, wherever the human has gone to. He just slipped off. I'm just looking around at my own staff. Mr. Human. Right. Because I see from our program here, and they would have known they need to be here until 1 o'clock. So, Ms. Medina, if you would follow that through. Yes. And I don't know when last we had such a hands-on engagement, am I correct, members of the committee, where you really were able to get down on the line to the wire and, ask these questions. And I hate using the word interrogation because it sounds like we're operating some court show. We're now going to have the manufacturing circle, and after that, Suchwood. And I know the manufacturing circle is here, but what I do need to ask, Ms. Fox, because I know you've been here before, are you alone? Right, no, that's fine. Just wanting to know who should be on board and who shouldn't be. So we're going to ask you to go ahead, and that's why I was hoping we had National Treasury here while this was going on. But do start.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Honourable Members, all protocol observed. We thank the opportunity, we grace the opportunity to present our position, manufacturing circle's position. First, just a brief background on the manufacturing circle, in that we function as a voice for South African manufacturing, and our purpose is to promote the interests of manufacturers to enable job-rich growth in the South African economy. We have a wide range of members, some of them are listed here, that span a diverse range of subsectors, from metals to paper and packaging, agro-processing, rail, capital equipment, pharmaceuticals. It's a wide range of different companies, and as a manufacturing circle, we serve to represent our members in terms of different cross-cutting interests that benefit the manufacturing industry as a whole. And within that context, our objectives in today's presentation are to present our perspective on the importance of local procurement, our position on whether technical support for localization is appropriate, and our insights regarding challenges and possible solutions. The manufacturing circle firmly supports the view that industrialization is critical in driving economic growth of our country, and we further believe that one of the key levers to industrialization is local procurement. Notwithstanding the legislation prescribed by the Preferential Procurement Policy Framework Act, we maintain that local procurement by the public sector is not always sufficiently complied with or monitored. And I would now like to present the various challenges and the areas where we deem to be the case. In the first instance, we'd like to tackle the position of the Department of Trade and Industry in the designation process. In the PPPFA, the Department of Trade and Industry is mandated to make a call on designation, and I'll get to that in a little more detail when we get to the proposed amended regulation. However, the decision-making body in terms of the procurement entity is not necessarily aligned with the DTI in terms of objectives from a commercial point of view, from pricing, for example. And we see that evidence in certain situations in the pharmacy industry, for example. Compounded to the DTI's challenges that there are a significantly large number of public procurement entities operating on various levels, which do not all have an understanding of the legislation and requirements and are not necessarily complying. The second set of challenges that we highlight have to deal with technical complexity. And this is a further comment, I think, on the debate that was raised earlier, in that in order to build a strong industrial base, we've got to deal with the complexity in terms of project type initiatives and industrialization, and not just acknowledge the ease and benefits of recurring procurement. So the likes of capital equipment rail are very important in this space. And we cite a specific example where loopholes sometimes arise. In the rail sector, for example, we have a member that produces cast train wheels for freight. And these are designated, but however, there's a substitute product that could be used for it's a different manufacturing process in the form of forging. And these train wheels are not designated. And in most cases, from a technical point of view, our member argues that the application is interchangeable. However, these forged train wheels are being imported. And it's due to a technical loophole, and this has had significant impact on the costing division of one of our members. In addition to specifications for certain products, there's also possibly a subset of the identification of designated items. Again, in a rolling stock scenario, our understanding is that rolling stock axles are now fully designated, and it's important that this is taken to its logical conclusion in that these items need to be identified when they come in as imported components as part of a larger whole. Again, we are highlighting loopholes where potential designated or dutiable products are still being imported under sort of a general term, staged consignments, for example, where the requirements for the designated item is not specified or identified. And we see this in the steel fabrication side of things as well. For example, with a food processing plant might be a catch-all phrase for something that should in fact be designated. Furthermore, we've seen indications where we've got quite complex procurement decision-making structures on projects. One of our members supplies components into the built environment sector. We're talking about hospitals in this particular scenario. And we've got a situation where we've got various government departments from Department of Health and the Department of Public Works making procurement decisions, also working with private sector contractors and consultants, and a firm and stable knowledge of the importance of local procurement is not fully dictated throughout the decision-making structure. And this, according to understanding, is resulting in the loss of the power of locally manufactured products in favour of imported components. A further issue that we have come across in instances is the scenario of competition. We have seen certain instances where the designation of a product has been motivated, but but has not been awarded due to perceived lack of competitiveness from a pricing point of view in the case where we have a single local supplier. And again, you know, this point is really to acknowledge the complexities of the technicalities of designation, and that we really need to work into them in an in-depth manner. One of our members, for example, is the only producer on the continent of a specialized product. It's called a geotextile clay liner. This product is used to line landfills or mine waste or ash dumps in the likes of what's produced as a byproduct in our coal-fired power stations. And what we need to understand is, although that this company is the only local supplier, there are a lot of imported competitors who are not necessarily more price competitive. And in the event that we were able to consider this certain product for designation, it would have a significant effect in the upstream scenario, in that this particular company in turn sources its three components for this product from local suppliers. So these are kind of conversations that we need to be having. So to get on to possible solutions now that we have identified the various challenges. First of all, maintaining the position of the DTI in mandating local procurement objectives. We note the notice by National Treasury regarding draft amendments to the Preferential Procurement Policy Framework Act, in which it is proposed that the designation of a sector, a subsector or industry is by the National Treasury after consultation with the DTI, whereas the current regulations mandate designation by the DTI. We motivated the manufacturing circle that the regulation is not amended as proposed, as this would effectively reduce the role of the Department of Trade and Industry. And we make this recommendation on the basis that the Department of Trade and Industry has a comprehensive understanding of the complexities and the complex nature of designation, and we feel it is important that this role is maintained. In addition, as a high-level suggestion, we also would like to recommend the strengthening of the position of the Department of Trade and Industry in mandating local procurement objectives. And this comes to later points where, as the private sector and the manufacturing circle, we are undertaking to try to quantify the benefits in a rand terms or percentage terms of making a decision to procure locally as opposed to import something which may be in some instances a little cheaper. And what we'd like to propose is an assessment of looking at a percentage of procurement budget which is in fact allocated to the Department of Trade and Industry to allow us to compensate for scenarios where the pricing of locally produced products is in fact higher within a given and stipulated percentage range. And this would allow for the commercial incentivization of local procurement decisions, similar to what we've seen in other incentive type measures. We also acknowledge the importance of the involvement in the private sector with associated technical expertise in communicating the public sector's local content commitments as legislated by the PPPA. And in the manufacturing circle, we are collaborating closely with the Southern African Institute of Steel Construction, SASIC, which has made significant progress over several years in the designation space. Their key message is that achieving designation legislation is really just the start of huge amounts of work that is required to ensure implementation. They've been working specifically with the area of steel power pylon, in addition to all the associated power line hardware that goes together with it, and have put in a significant amount of time and effort and work with the procurer, the state-owned enterprise, EFRAM in this case, in terms of educating the procurement department as to the fact that this legislation does exist, and going to significant amount of detailed intervention so that when, for example, one of those products needs to be procured, making sure that on the respective procurement computer system, it's known that this is designated and where the respective supply can be sourced. In addition, just to mention another activity that SAFIC is involved with is looking at a scenario of where a designated product is part of a larger piece of equipment, as in the case of imported axle components as part of a part of rolling stock. They're doing a lot of work with SARS customs in terms of education there, and to the practical level of having connections with customs so that if a customs official is unsure about whether an item should be designated or not, or is deemed to be a component that needs to have a tariff or not, taking a picture of it on a cell phone and sending it through to SAFEC for confirmation of whether they should be concerned or not. And these are some of the practical interventions that we acknowledge and like to be part of. And then in addition, the speaker after me is going to talk about positive developments in terms of monitoring and compliance. And we acknowledge what SACDRU has been doing in terms of a very comprehensive program that's been over significant amount of years to make sure that in the textile industry, local procurement compliance is adhered to. And then as a further solution, and you know, the two that I've mentioned in the case of SAFEC and SACDRU have to do with proactive engagement. But then on the other side, in terms of it's more reactive, but we'd also like to suggest introduction of punitive measures in the event that compliance does not take place through involvement of the Auditor General of South Africa. And another thing that can be done in conjunction with the private sector is increasing awareness, both within public and private realms, of the economic importance of local procurement, the existence of the PPPFA, and the importance of compliance. One of the initiatives that the Manufacturing Circle is undertaking together with the DTI and the State of Enterprise Procurement Forum, or SIF, is an information session aimed at our private sector members, as well as private sector consultants in the built environment, to communicate the importance of local content procurement, what the mechanics are of the PPPFA, and case studies showing successes achieved by basic and factory in compliance and monitoring. We would also like to acknowledge as the Manufacturing Circle that there has been insufficient local procurement within the private sector, and we are patently aware of this. We attribute this part to a lack of understanding of the economic importance of local procurement and the benefits to our economy with regard to the multiplier effect. There also at the moment is absence of a single voice and a strong campaign in this regard. We are busy addressing the issue. We have commissioned an economic analysis report that attempts to unpack the benefits of the economic multiplier effect. Economic multiplier generated by a local manufacturer, and this analysis in turn aims to quantify the benefits so that we can start having the debates where you know we've got a price differential in terms of a local product versus an imported product. And that is my presentation. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Rogers. Thank you very much. And I think we've got Mr. Simon Apple here, just over here, from SACDRU, if you come to the front of you. Also going to use some laptop, but you all set up. Stay in the front though, Ms. Rogers, okay? Let's just move over, because we will be engaging both of you at the same time. Let's just sit alongside Mr. Apple. Thank you very much. All right. Mr. Simon Apple, thank you very much, and it was a very good idea just to remind us about commitments we've made to ensure you were back this time for the colloquium. It's good to have that proactive approach. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you to the Chair, thank you, Honourable Members. Good day to other delegates and participants.
My name is Simon Ebel. I work for the Southern African Clothing and Textile Workers Trade Union, which is one of the COSATU trade unions. We want to give you a presentation today of some of the work that we've done around local content. We call it local content activism or advocacy work. And the level lessons we want to draw out of the presentation for you. So I realize that much of the discussion thus far has particularly been on rail, etc. Our lessons may not apply directly to rail, but probably obliquely they can be related to it, and certainly they will relate to many other products, certainly not just clothing and textiles. Just quickly a little overview. Southern African Clothing and Textile Workers Union has around 100,000 members, predominantly in the manufacture of clothing and textiles, footwear products and leather products like bags, belts, etc. We operate in around 1,500 workplaces around the country, so we're a national union operating very much nationally. The members of this committee will know well that the clothing and textile industry has been in trouble for many years, at least 15 years or so, with large numbers of jobs being about 160,000 around there. The fortune of the industry have begun to stabilize more recently, and that's very much due to the involvement of the state and its industrial policies. But there are sort of adjunct activities which have taken place too, and one of those we would claim some victory for as a trade union, which is the running of what we call our jobs campaign. The jobs campaign is a set of tasks, about 40 or more projects the union runs with a direct intention to stabilize jobs and grow the industry. And one arm of that is directing orders of factories. So how do you make sure that workers don't lose jobs and that they have security at work? Well, you make sure that there's enough work in their factories. I mean, that's one of the easy ones, apart from defending against workers' discrimination. And it's in that context that our procurement advocacy takes place. We made a case to the state for many years, I think possibly from the 1990s, but certainly the early 2000s onwards, that the state should be buying locally made products. In our case, it was clothing and textiles, but we argue for it more broadly, too. So that's a long-standing advocacy issue for us, and it's something that we acted on prior to the local content policies happening, both in the terms of engaging with the state, but also by encouraging local manufacturers over many years to actually supply the state. We used to collect tenders from the tender bulletins and send it up regularly every week to factories. So when the policy of designation came about, when clothing and textiles, footwear and leather were finally designated around 2012, we were very excited and we decided to ask ourselves, is it working? We embarked on around 6 months worth of research. The research was trawling annual reports of states, institutions, it was going through budgets, awarded tenders, finding tenders, analyzing them, all kinds of activities. And it took us to a stage where I'll present some of the findings in a moment, but it took us to a stage where we realized that the local content policies had some very, very significant flaws. That research continues because we're involved in ongoing work in this field. So I've broken the findings down essentially into two components, and I think it's from these that we can build the remainder of the conversation that we have, or the presentation that I present. The first set of findings is that the scale of designation is vast. I'm not sure if the DTI presented this in their input from the DDG, but there are over 700 public institutions empowered to procure goods and services in the state. If you go through the schedule of public entities, provincial entities, you tally that up with municipal entities, the number of municipalities, number of national government departments, provincial government departments, it starts heading towards 800. And by law, each of the entities is empowered to conduct its own procurement. And in that process, procurement is decentralized. So the decisions around buying goods or services essentially belong to thousands of, well, hundreds of public institutions and thousands of supply chain management officials. And that's the tricky spider web, is that to get policies that are passed both by or legislation that's passed by Parliament and policies which are passed by the state and enacted by the state, to get those effective, it's got to find compliance from hundreds of public institutions, and thousands of individuals who are responsible for making those purchasing decisions. And that's an enormously complicated thing, especially since there are tens of thousands of procurement transactions which happen every year. So I guess the implicit message is the scope for failure is enormous because it's a sieve, the number of opportunities for mistakes to be made. So the second part of our findings is that decentralization causes problems. And we've sketched those briefly there. The one significant problem is that the tender market is opaque. And I'll sketch it for you here. So because each institution is empowered to do their own procurement, each institution is also empowered then to advertise their own tenders and their awarded tenders. And until recently, increasingly now to some extent and less so in the future, they put those on their websites, in publications, newspapers, a vast number, hundreds, national, provincial, regional gazettes, etc. They also publish them to a lesser extent, less successfully, in the tender bulletins. So to find the information about the tender market is extremely difficult. And that's important because it means that policymakers actually are not able to see what's going on in the market. If you want to know whether or not designated products are currently being requested by the state, there's no way to know that. National Treasury is making a stab at this at the moment through the e-tender portal. I think we would disagree with them that it's successful. It has some success, but it's got very limited success at the moment. The majority of tenders simply don't appear in an aggregate collected form, if that makes any sense. The second challenge there, though, is that your local manufacturers, they're the ones at the back end who are supposed to be approaching the tenders. You're supposed to, the local content policy essentially is supposed to be driving, using state demand to drive industrial development. But if local manufacturers have no sense of the tender market, they simply cannot tender. And that's what's happening at the moment, is that many manufacturers simply don't know the opportunities in the state, and the state doesn't really know its own opportunities. A third complication there is because the tender market is so opaque and because it's so regionalized, it's really dominated by intermediary traders. So factories very seldom sell to the states. One, because they don't know what's going on, and two, because supply chains in the states simply don't work like that. For some good reasons, which are BEE reasons, and many industries remain white, overwhelmingly dominated by white people, so that creates those manufacturers to be locked out of the system. But for less good reasons, they're also locked out. And that's simply because they don't know what's going on. Traders, intermediaries then become a problem in the mix. Because if they're not aware of local content policies, or if they don't want to make the system work, they can import goods. They can sign the local content declaration when they fill in a tender, which is invariably what happens. They'll say that they're providing 100% local content to the state. State supply chain officials will receive that document, believe that the goods are local, and meanwhile there's been a fraudulent transaction which is taking place. And that's an enormously complicated gap which exists. Due to this, there's a lot of local content leakage, including, despite our activism and our advocacy, there's local content leakage in our sectors too. The next major finding that we had is that the economies of scale are wasted because of decentralization. So if you indulge me for a moment to explain with an example, in the municipalities there are many functions, classifications of employees who could ostensibly wear clothing. I'm greatly self-interested in using our example. So you would have employees in the roads transport sector, the safety and security components, the water management, the wastewater management. And each of those workers is categorized or calculated differently. Now, across the municipalities, and there's almost 300, you may have, I can't remember the number at this point, maybe 180,000 employees in the municipalities. But because of centralization, you essentially take aggregate demand and you break it up into the smallest one. So, for example, in Saldanha Bay Municipality, the wastewater management unit there will buy for itself, and it may only have 8 employees. In Newcastle, they may have 24 people in the roads and transport unit who require uniforms, but they'll buy for 24. Yet at the aggregate numbers, we're talking tens of thousands of units. And that's a wastage of state money because we're squandering those economies of scale. So really, decentralization, we believe, is the core challenge that inhibits local content success. From our findings and from our research, we've developed a set of policy positions and proposals, and those are up there on the screen. The first one is that there needs to be centralization of procurement to some extent. That's a swear word policymakers, because they believe that centralization can be bad, but there must be many ways to make it work. One could aggregate tenders into one space and do collective buying. That's the most obvious form of it. But the other form could be, as opposed to doing buying in one place, you might want to centralize it provincially, for example. So provincial governments become responsible for central buying. You might decide that that treasury buys centrally for certain functions in municipalities. So there are multiple ways to realize an objective of centralization and to do it strategically to make a use of the economy scale. The second proposal is to make the market transparent, and I'll spend a bit of time on that at the moment. But really, because the market is opaque, it leads to the dysfunction with local content. If manufacturers and government can't find each other and don't know how to find each other, and if manufacturers can't watch intermediaries and traders and whistleblow when there are problems, then you've got a problem market. But if you have a transparent market, one provides the opportunity for stakeholders to exercise their self-interest and defend the interests. I'll explain that briefly also afterwards. The next proposal would be to monitor procurement much more strictly than is happening at the moment and exercise greater sanctions, and the manufacturing circle has referred to some of that. And the fourth one there is that currently a lot of procurement that takes place appears to pay little regard to the issue of labor compliance in factories. So it is possible at the moment for the states to procure goods from set shops, and that is anathema to the duty of the state to uphold the rule of law. So we draw our proposals from our classroom. The classroom that we have is the work that we do on tender advocacy. I'm going to describe that for you now, honorable members, that we've taken steps to centralize tender data ourselves. We've learned lessons from doing that. We've taken steps to mobilize the market, and we've taken steps to intervene problems that we find. So we've called for the need to centralize tenders. What we've done in our instance, because the information is so devolved, disparate, opaque, and decentralized, we've developed a system to watch the websites of over 700 websites. It equates to roughly about 500 public institutions that we can watch on a daily basis what are they procuring. And it allows us to extract all the currently open tenders and all the awarded tenders, so that we're aware of what's going on in the market. So over a six-month period in 2015, we collected 1,000 clothing, textile, footwear, leather tenders. I can promise you that those tenders, by and large, were not on Treasury's e-portal because they're not making it there. And they constituted hundreds of thousands of units of clothing. This is what it looks like, and I put this up, honorable members, so that you can see what is required in order to see what's going on in the state. This is the program that we use. Along the left-hand side, you can see the departments, or at least the kind of classifications of departments, and a number of websites under each is the kind of red number predominantly on the right-hand side of that bar on the left. So that's the system that we use. Then once we have the data needs to make its way into the market. And to do so, we have to work very actively in partnerships. So we have partnerships with manufacturers, with employer associations, and with others. What we do is we take the information, we boil it into a very simplistic form, and we email it, usually on around a daily basis, to manufacturers to say, these are tenders in the market that you'll find. We send directly to manufacturers, and we send to employer associations. We ask them to send to their members. As a result, our tender alerts reach around 500 factories in the country. We work with public institutions, so we recognize that National Treasury and the DTI, the lead departments in this program, don't know what's happening in the market, so we bring our information to them and we say to them, here's what's happening, these are the tenders required today. As you'll see, most of them have no requirement for local content in the advertised notice. Kindly investigate to see whether local content does apply, and if it does apply, industry go ahead and bid. We also then work directly with public institutions to do procuring, to engage them on the need for local content, and we also, I suppose, intervene with them if we find they're not using local content. We bring the information to the attention of suppliers and traders, those who we know source from local manufacturers. We bring the information for them, and we also activate union officials. We let them have information to bring it to the attention of factories. So we call it mobilizing the market, which is essentially what we're doing. And there are a couple of principles that underlie it. And the first one is that we provide the information for free, and really a way to get the market activated is for this information to be freely available, because it maximizes uptake. And we seek to render the market transparent. So we communicate openly. You know, if we take issue with a public institution who appears to be procuring goods from a company that we think is importing, we don't simply communicate with a public institution. We communicate with a public institution in front of 40 manufacturers who provide that product, as well as a supplier, so that there's a public discussion happening about how to resolve the problem, what is the problem, and so that manufacturers are enabled, if they so desire, to use the various mechanisms that exist to challenge tenders. We also turn challenges into opportunities. So you know, where we find contracts that have been awarded to intermediaries, we find the cell phone numbers of the owners of the intermediaries, the traders, we find their phone numbers, their names, and we send it to factories and say, this company has won a tender for this amount of money, you need to go and phone them and see if you can supply them. And really, the key point behind that is being able to get factories to have enough information that they can fight for their piece of the pie. Outcomes, and we'll do this briefly, is that manufacturers have taken an interest in the market. They've been able to bid directly and indirectly for tenders. They monitor tenders and they share information back with us and with each other. So you get an entire whistleblowing community which exists because people are mobilized and enthusiastic. For policymakers and officials, they've begun to learn what the market looks like. It's not simply a technical exercise of constructing law and trying to enact it, but it's having a good sense of what happens in the market so that we can respond to it, intervene, adjust, evaluate, etc. And the next point is that it also assists departments with the ability to start to collaborate with each other so that the jurisdictional battles start to fall away and departments can recognize their common ground exists for further work together. The public institutions we've engaged with have the opportunity to learn more about local content, and workers from outside have the opportunity to take some hold of this process. So I don't want to give a false impression, honourable members, that there is 100% compliance or even the best and rosiest picture to tell about what's happening with clothing and textiles in the state. By and large, there continues to be non-compliance. By and large, there continues to be importation. But there are still problems. Manufacturers find that government has short lead times, they can't respond, there's too many imports, there's not enough monitoring. But the work that we've done, I think, is beginning to yield path, which has some benefit. So these are some of the quotes that we collected a couple of weeks ago from manufacturers. I won't read all of them, but essentially the manufacturers are recognizing that by knowing what's going on in the market, they've been able to enter it. There have been positive developments both for the growth of orders to companies and in some instances the growth of employees in companies as a consequence of having new orders. So for example, one of the textile factories has grown its production of high visibility tapes, those luminous tapes one would use in security clothing, as a result of local content policies. Another company got 160,000 new units of orders. Another company got new orders of leather products for the boot train. And another company has managed to now move to about 1,500 employees. It basically doubled its employment since local content policies came about, and largely but not only as a result of the success of local content. So at that point, honourable members, I'm going to begin to close and just direct to a couple of key points. The first is that there is enormous potential in the local content policies. It's a fantastic policy, and it needs to remain. It needs to be fought for if there are challenges against it, and it can succeed. The second is that there are significant obstacles which exist, and importation does continue to exist, and we need to tackle that. And the third one is that, you know, from our learning, we would say that really centralization and transparency are the keys here. The tender market is, as we've said, enormously decentralized. That creates huge obstacles to the state and to government for realizing its policy objectives, and there will have to be work taken, surely, at some level to bring back procurement into a much more manageable form, so that it doesn't pass through the hands of hundreds or of thousands of supply chain management officials, so that our key products that we want to drive industrial growth on aren't being managed by hundreds of different public institutions. And I think that's the message that we want to leave you with, Honourable Members. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Eiffel. You spelled out your the proposal, the sector, very clearly. Thank you very much for that. And while I'm mentioning that, some of the other presenters yesterday and today did allude to some of these proposals, but that's very important. It's not just a question of these are the challenges, this is what we've done, but how can we both put it right? What measures and mechanisms have you identified in your sphere that will assist us in this regard? So that is something those of you who haven't had the or forgot, or there was a little oversight, or it's not clear, please write back to us with some of these suggestions. Thank you very much. We then move on to the Railroad Association of South Africa. Mr. B, is it Mangeu. And the only thing is I don't know your designation. What's your designation for the associate?
I'm going to be the CEO of the association.
So, the CEO, thank you very much for being here this morning. This was an association that heard that we were putting on the colloquium, and very much like the union was proactive in saying, well, shouldn't we be there? Can we please make a presentation? You're very welcome. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you to the members. I really appreciate the fact that we for an opportunity to come and present here. Just a bit of background, the Rail Association of South Africa is an association consisting of operators, OEMs, the suppliers. Now, it puts our position in an awkward situation because we have to juggle between the needs of the suppliers and the OEMs. I've listened here to all the people that have made presentations, particularly the OEMs and the discussions around here. I think there's been a lot of concentration on the compliance by the OEMs. We make it a submission from the RRA, that's the Railroad Association, that to us compliance is very critical because we would like to know what makes our suppliers not to comply to do the work with the OEMs, so that we can start then a conversation around what intervention needs to take place. Going forward, when we look at the rail industry with the localization, we see it as an opportunity for the rail industry of South Africa to expand so that it can play an active role in the export market. The Rail Association being an export council, advocate and it try by all means to make sure that we generate work for the industry. Now, unfortunately, for us to be able to do that, we need to understand the capacity of the South African rail industry. And we thought out of localization, the OEMs were to report to us and say, we are unable to make use of your suppliers in South Africa due to the following reason. Now we all agree that we could have been having a different conversation. How do we intervene to our industry so that our industry becomes competitive? I've just given the background of of RRA we had discussions with SABS. Madam Chair, we also have discussions with the DPI because the sector of the DPI is part of us. When we had a discussion with SABS about how can we form a secretariat to look on how can the localization be implemented, we look at localization as a market for South African companies. As a market to a point then that we can be in a position as an association to start to talk about other policies that are supposed to be implemented. We never thought that then the localization can have such hurdles. When the discussion was and the question was, who is going to pay for this? And I took a brief and then I said to the response, our suppliers are badly affected by the lack of knowledge on how the localization is working. And I said, RRA will pay. That's what I said. And with no knowledge of where we're going to get that money, but we saw it as knowing or verifying the local content as very critical towards the industrial development, that is the rail industry of South Africa. Now, taking on our mandate, it is in the interest of RRA to revitalize the rail industry of South Africa. Technical band of excellence to the rail. Technical trend of excellence represent the industry of the network council that I've already mentioned. Given the emergence of rail interest in the African market, as an export council, we saw it fit to accelerate the export and the development of companies in the rail industry through the rail chain. Philippa from Manufacturing Cycle just mentioned around technical specs. We are very aware of the fact that when you deal with the rail chain, most of our rail projects across, be it in South Africa or elsewhere in the African continent, are derived from a combination of technical requirements and the financing model. And now, in most cases, the EPCs, engineering procurement constructions, that are at the beginning of the project, they are always linked with where the finance comes from. And as a result, when you talk of technical specs in line to the rail chain, you'll find that the OEMs, therefore, and losses of connections with global supply chain. But they very firm, they would prefer to make use of their suppliers. And now, if a country, developing country like South Africa, we get to a confusion like we are today, they grab on it, they run with it, because it gives them an opportunity not to comply. So we always push that we need to accelerate.
One moment, Honourable Matash. I'm very much uncomfortable when the presenter says South Africa is confused. I don't think we are confused. Can you put a better word?
Okay, now I think as an industry, rail, South African rail industry, at this point in time, we struggle to know where our suppliers, what kind of development needs to be in place so that they can comply with the OEMs, whether the OEMs are making an effort to get to our suppliers, that it talks to verification. It's not really the country, I'm talking the rail industry at the point, and it becomes a self-concern to us. Because of the value chain that we need to control. If you lose on the value chain, if you lose on the design at the engineering level, normally it becomes very difficult to get to the supply chain because specs, they favor those that they're involved at the APC level. Allowing the industry development initiatives for future growth, we see an opportunity in South Africa where we have a government who's very willing, government who said, let's have a local content as a law in South Africa. And from that, we also view that let's build the base. From the local content implementation, let's build the base for future growth. Remember, the contracts that we have here in South Africa, they're not going to be there forever. Forever is coming to an end within 18 years, and not next. That's why we pay ourselves to build the industry that can be competitive in the African market. Identify and profile projects in the region that we are already doing. We try to identify all projects in the region and let us know what is required there. Is our industry, is the rail industry of South Africa, capable? Can we compete with the Chinese in the African market? Can we compete with the companies from Europe in the African market? At this point in time, we thought that the localization was going to assist us because most of our OEMs are not really from South Africa. And they were to give us a feedback to say, these are the issues that we are having. Quality-related, lean processes, etc., etc. And we struggled to get that information. That was the reason that the SABS asked us, who is going to pay? And we said, no, we can pay because we are badly affected. South African industry on the local, on the supply side, is badly affected when we get to a point where we are not sure what is happening. Position South Africa as an industrial hub for the rail components in the region, of which it's a declaration that has been given to us by African Union that South Africa must be an industrial hub for rail components in the region. But are we having knowledge of what is happening in the industry? That's quite a number of discussions, even at the research point of view. There are lots of pockets all over the place that they don't get together so that we know exactly what is our capacity. So through a local content or localization, we work to view that this is going to be an opportunity to position the industry, an opportunity to know our weaknesses in line to the OEMs, an opportunity to take the industry to the African market, where we think we have an advantage. In line with the export drive of our African government, RRA has to enable the industry to have comprehensive insights into the real opportunities, position the industry in advance, significantly increase the number of opportunities beyond which each firm. Rail projects, by their nature, they're very tricky because you need to combine technology, finance, and to an extent, regulatory framework. And they long term. You might have a technology, but you don't have finance. Now, that is how we see the rail industry, through this local content, building capacity, come up with models that will work and take it to the African continent without concentrating on one company has to finance the project through the balance sheet, but now we go as a package that will assist the export capacity of the rail industry in South Africa. Identify potential linkages and partnership in the region. Of course, that should dovetail to the program of infrastructure development in Africa. The project trade and investment in the region has become increasingly globalized, as I've already mentioned. But now this product, if you are not packaging yourself as a country in this case, I think we're supposed to learn a lot from the China. If you are packaging yourself, you are always outperformed. And that is what we're trying to drive. We have advantages in the continent, the proximity to other countries in the region, understanding the business demand and product suitability perspective, advanced political advantage of being integrated in the region. So those are the advantages. It doesn't make sense to us as in the South Africa that we were outpaced by China in the African market while we have such advantages. But if we don't know what we are capable of, and if we don't make use of the laws like designation to build capacity, because we see designation or local content as a route to build real OEMs from South Africa, of which that is what we are currently lacking. The model of TE and China, we are welcoming that. Where a transnational engineering will end up being a real OEM that can compete. We've seen their presentation on the Africa Rail. The two major limitations I've already mentioned for the South African rail industry is the financing and technology. Now, as an association, we are pioneering an establishment of a SA Rail Corporation. And this SA Rail Corporation is motivated by the fact that we've got the designation policy to ask for you to be able to implement other laws that talk to transformation and so forth. You need to create market for your members. You need to create market for the industry. And I've called Prada Transnet several times in our sessions. And I always say, tell us how much amount of money is meant for localization. They will give us numbers. And we know also have that because our real industry is traditionally white industry. And if you give us numbers and saying we can't then be in a position to say to white firms, listen, for you to turn in this market, you need to do something about the scorecard. Those are the interventions that we probably should be talking about. And going forward then, we have a real industry that is capable. Modernize the industry technology. We're slightly behind the technology because we've been running a maintenance program for our networks and locomotives and the rolling stock. Now, when we have to go out in the African continent where we are concentrating, we are always outpaced based on the technology. And that I've already mentioned, it talks to specs or engineering design. Engineering design, that is mostly taken from PPC engineering procurement construction that is normally linked to the financial institution. We need to reskill the workforce, build capacity in the form of industry clusters. Now, these industry clusters are very close to us because that's the area where we feel strongly that you will be able to build capacity for the sector. We intend to have these industry clusters to integrate them with the DFI, the Developmental Finance Institution, because we know very well that most of our companies, they might have a technical capability, but due to cash is king in any business, and depends on the whole training project. Now we're pushing for these industry clusters, but we thought that is how important this localization is to us. We thought out of this localization, when we build these clusters, we know very well that our local suppliers don't comply with certain aspects of the requirements of the OEM. Remember, when you talk of compliance, you have mentioned it, we are not looking on the OEMs only. We're looking on the feedback from the OEM telling us that we are unable to make use of your companies due to the following. And then thereafter, we look and say what sort of interventions can we come up with. Integrate the industry with the financial institutions that I've already mentioned.
You've got 10 minutes available.
Yeah. Now, if you look, when you talk of building capacity, going to the African market, we've got advantages in South Africa, but we need to build capacity here. If you go out there, if you check all the what is in there, is the standard gauge. That is our Cape gauge. That runs all over. It takes almost 80% of the infrastructure of the network that we can continue. Out of this, then, we need to push the standards, so that we can influence the engineering design that normally exclude our people. And it's an opportunity. It's an opportunity that we're supposed to tap on it, and that is why we're saying we could have been advanced at this point in time. And we have an advantage where there's commitment from government to build inclusive growth, the declaration by the AU, of course our experience on the brownfield project that we have to build, brownfield, that we have to build up to greenfield, so that we can be more competitive. The institutional framework of the country. Now, we propose the secretariat. That's the secretariat that we're presenting here. The secretariat that will include the industry, the DCI, and the SABS. And we thought that SABS will give us feedback to say, these are the concerns of the OEMs. And then we will get the feedback from the OEMs to say, this is what we're doing to really develop the industry. That can be sort of verification then. It's not going to be an easy route. We understand it's complex, but now what are we able to? We need to make sure that our industry adhere to standards, adhere to the equipment required, engineering and inclusive growth. And that's it. Now, talking of the opportunities that exist there, you'll see the minerals in the SADC region. We also have challenges here to integrate the rail network within the SADC region. This is what it says as far as the intra regional trade in the world. That means there are opportunities for the African, South African rail industry, because South Africa, the African continent is way, way behind. These are all the opportunities that are just thrown in. The African rivals, we're already doing some, we have discussions with Kenya, in line with the project that they have, the urbanization here. This is one
thing. Page 15. You know, the one where you've got Africa and all indicating the mineral deposits. What does that blue, light blue, those lines, linear, you see that?
With where?
Oh, there, you see, well, there we are, you can see it over here, blue.
The blue?
Yeah, what does that represent? Now, we realize they're lines and not circles. What do they represent?
Louis Petroleum, if you see on the right.
No, no, not the bullets, the lines. You see, you've sketched.
Oh, yeah, these are networks, sir.
Networks?
Yeah, yeah.
Along that corridor?
Yes, yeah.
Okay. So we have a network running from the west coast to the east coast, from Angola to Zimbabwe.
Yeah.
But of course Mozambique on the west in the east coast.
Yeah, yeah.
I wasn't aware we had that railway line.
And then we carry on. This is a state of infrastructure.
Are you sure about that railway line? You know, the one that's showing, you've written Angola here, Tatiana, just above there, it shows from the west coast, right across to the east coast, a rail line. I'm certainly not aware of it. This is news to me.
You see, on the right, this side, it shows that there's a cargo moving somewhere up there, as a result, be it planned, but there's a cargo moving somewhere.
All right, I don't understand. I don't know if any other member of the committee was able to work that one out. I think you're going to have to explain it in detail to us, because there is no rail line from the west coast to the east coast. One rail line. There isn't.
Remember, what is in colors is explained on the side. What is, you see that you've got your manganese, you've got all those. That then push to a point that you're supposed to integrate. You're supposed to integrate the network. Yeah. Okay. Okay. Our giving just opportunities within the African continent. These are the countries that have concentration now. And of course, we are talking to Kenya. And all this, we are saying, if we can get local content right in South Africa, we are in a position to build reasonable capacity to assist with all the challenges in the African continent. This is what we're talking with the Kenya guys, the LabSat project, and therefore quite a number of opportunities there. Now, our understanding here is, through localization, let's build capacity so that we can go to the market. Our submission, Madam Chair, is we also the view that if DDI and the Railroad Association and SABS can work together, this capacity can be built and to a point that the rail industry of South Africa can really participate to the export market and be a significant player in the African continent with our experience of running our own maintenance through brownfield projects. But we are aware of the fact that we have such impediments, the complexity of regulation, technology and finance, the misunderstanding of the role of institutional structures, stroke business models, preference of big business to use their supply chain that I've already mentioned. If we struggle honestly with verification, how much more struggle are we supposed to have to agree on engineering designs that talks to specifications, that talks to who's supposed to be doing work? Because in most cases, our companies on the supply side are checked out, or the pricing is completely out. That's why that flyer talks to standards. Let's be involved in standards, let's be involved in engineering design, so that we can be in a position to control the supply chain. Of course, I've mentioned that the real cost structure is a function of the technology. Madam Chair, I thank you very much. Our submission is we would like to see a real working relationship between SABS, DDI, RRA, and together we invite the operators now and again, not to monitor only designation policy, but to deal with issues of industry development that makes use of the tools that are in place, designation, supply development, you mentioned all of them, so that we can have a formidable package for the African market to compete. That's the reason I've seen those slides that talk of what is the state of rail in the African continent. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I don't know what the number is, but you've given interventions here very clearly outlined, you know, so thank you very much on that one. And it does include the issue of quality standards and the alignment. But the appeal you've made is that there's greater synergy and coordination between these different stakeholders in order to enable a policy to be effectively implemented. I think that's what you really said. And thank you very, very much. We're going to have to, in future, keep in touch with you so we have a closer relationship. This is the first time you've engaged with us. Am I correct?
Yes.
And thank you very much. All right. Members, we're at the point of questions and responses. So I'm not sure. I think we did tackle the National Treasury on verification issues, so we already have a position there. So let's raise these questions, Honourable Williams, Honourable Mkongi, and Honourable Matash, in that order.
Thanks, Chairperson. Once again, I'd like to thank you for the presentations. I have three questions. My first question is to the manufacturing circle. I just want to know, does the DTI know about the situation with the train wheel loophole and other loopholes that you've raised with them? And I'd like to know how helpful they've been in addressing these loopholes. And my next question is to National Treasury, and I know they might not be able to answer this today, but we would like some sort of answer. Why does National Treasury want to designate and not the DTI? There must be some reason for that, bearing in mind that National Treasury's core function isn't trade and industry, so I'm just wondering why they want control of that. And lastly, to the union, when they bring tenders that don't stipulate local procurement to the DTI, are these queries dealt with quickly and efficiently? And basically, are you happy with how the DTI is assisting you with regards to this? Thank you.
Honourable Williams, Honourable Mkongi.
Thank you very much. I didn't concur with Honourable Williams. I must raise it that I'm very impressed with the presentation of the manufacturing sector. But I'm just worried about their relationship with the DTI. Whether what they're presenting here is what the DTI knows. Because most of the proposals and how are we supposed to intervene, for me, some of them are groundbreaking. For an example, the question that they're asking about designation of consumer to DTI and so forth, I wanted to ask DTI whether this is going to be an added burden to them, or it could be a function that they have been doing and therefore it's part and parcel of their work. It was very important that we understand that. And if that is the case, when we meet with the Portfolio Committee on Finance, these are the issues that we sit on and make sure that we don't hamper the work of DTI to deal. But I wanted to propose that we take some of these suggestions and put them as part of our proposal for future. From SAPT or to SAPT, there's something that you can raise around the question of limited success of local public procurement. Do you think that corruption is playing a role in this thing? Because you gave us your research, your desktop, or your person-to-person, is there any sense that corruption can play a significant role during this process? I think this was also particularly interested on the role of the intermediaries to disinform the industry on the issues and what could be the issues that are at play in that relationship between the state. Because you find that if industry is having full information and capitalists are going to say positive, right information, then they are going to go straight to the state, you know, and discover it. So what's their role there? Lastly, to the red industry. I thought, especially, that because of this red industry, and you are talking about the local public procurement, they are going to provide us with solutions. Because when I'm reading your whole presentation, all responsibility that they're putting into the state. That the state must do this and what that is, the state must do this. The only intervention that you are putting there, which is not the annual intervention, is the question of the secretariat. But you don't tell me what is your role, in making so that you are supporting the objectives of the local public procurement. Not because of the industry is full of white people, not because of that, but because of the industry is interested in the national goal of inclusive growth and creation of employment in the country. I don't care that. So if you can try to elaborate around that particular thing, that I think that is going to help us to deal with this particular issue. Thank you. Because if that question goes in the question, do you want the state to build capacity and capability of the industry? Or the industry is putting itself at the service of the nation to build that capacity and capability for its own end members as an association? This is what I am trying to get.
Thank you, Honorable Nkongi, Honorable Mantashe.
I also did not focus my previous speakers, but they share their views. In as far as the rail, the latter fit, it was always been, you know, apportioning all the proposals unto the stage. And it doesn't come out clearly what is your role in trying to assist the stage, you know, to succeed in its quest to ensure that local content is realized. I just want to ask one question from you. Why do you want it about your own organization being assisted by the state to succeed? I'm not getting out of your presentation, or you have not said whether you, why you are worried about your being empowered or developed. Do you have you taken any stride in trying to ensure that when you are not there, as an organization, the young blood that is coming to take over what you're doing now, or you're concerned about your own people now? I've not heard you saying this. In as far as human capital development, have you offered any bursaries to ensure that when you people who are in the other now are no more, we can have the young blood coming into your shoes? And that for me is a big concern. And then it's unionist section. Did you see that around the FFPF, did you look at it? Yes. Oh, okay. Because what I hear from you is that you agree with us that we need that document to be taken to this committee so that as lawmakers we can make our own input. I appreciate the work you've done. You know, it's not all of the unions that are existing that can go to that government to assist the government, you know, to move forward in realizing its objective of ensuring that there's continuous or sustainable job for the country, you know, and we really need our local content to be observed at all times. I appreciate very much. I'm happy that in your interview you are asking us, you are concerned with us that we need that document to come back to this country. Because it has some gap that we are finding now. Thanks, Dr. Phil.
Thank you very much, Honourable Tashi. Yes, with respect to the manufacturing circle, I recall this is what, about 5 years old now, the manufacturing circle? Is that correct?
We were established in 2008.
The proposals you've also put forward here, very interesting, and the same goes for the unions. There's always, I'm not saying everything will be taken on board, but very valuable to have it, in particular some of the findings that you've you haven't got pages in future. I think do try and have pages or side numbers. You know, it's so much easier. And it speaks to many of the things raised, challenges, Manufacturing Circle also noted, as well as the Railroad Association, who re-emphasized that. What was interesting here was your call to make market transparent. So I don't think anyone has a real challenge with it. It links to the point made in earlier presentations of the need to try and get some synchronization so data can come out. We're just not getting an accurate reflection of the market in this regard with respect to localization. The other issue that you raised was partnerships, and I'm sure a few others may have done that. I think, you know, the government is very intent on supporting public-private partnerships, but also the private sector developing partnerships between itself and different sectors. That is so important, but with procurement, as you know, we can only really lay down regulation with respect to, and that's regarding procurement, public procurement. I'm sure that's been explained over and over again. But when it comes to the private sector, and this is particularly directed at you, the Manufacturing Circle, it is very important that you realize you are operating in South Africa. And it is important, if you've given this enabling environment, please try and implement localization as effectively as it can be, and call our attention to some of the challenges you have. Because in the end, we're in this together, all of us. So on that particular note, I would very much appreciate your responses to the questions raised and the comments. Thank you. I don't know if you'd like to start with.
To respond to Honorable Mkongi, I think, and Mantashe. Honorable Mantashe. I don't think the Rail Association sees itself as being dependent on the state, but the nature of rail investment itself is an investment that generally it is taken by a country, by the state. Maybe must there be a confusion, as I've continuously mentioned in the state. For example, if we are to go and...
Be more specific. Are you confused, or who is confused? I think this member Mantashe, Honorable Mantashe, has raised this. I think I know what you mean, but let's make it clear. This is on Hansard. And I don't want to get any misunderstanding. Yeah. If you're saying South Africa is confused, then we have a serious problem. What exactly are you saying?
The South African rule, from the perspective of Rail Association, we are confused because we don't really have a data in our disposal that is indicating that the OEMs are incapable of making use of our local suppliers. To a point then that we come up with real interventions. Now we're moving back and forth around it. That is the confusion. And it's in our interest to know exactly why the OEMs can resist to work with our suppliers so that we can fine-tune our suppliers going forward. As we are saying, we're looking to the African market. I was explaining the role of the state in the rail investment. I was saying the nature of the rail itself, it's the risk is always taken care of by the state. In our cases, we're Transnet and Prasa that are both state-owned enterprises. If you go to Zimbabwe, for example, you're going to have National Railways of Zimbabwe. Now, when you try to get involved in there, you will always prefer to get involved through the entry of the state. So that is the reason that we it's not to say we're saying the state must do a lot of, but we are saying facilitation process, it requires the state. The association all the time is very much keen to report the provenance and take the industry to a particular country where the investment is, where is cargo, where is the traffic, etc. In terms of the solution, we are saying a working relationship between the industry and the verification board, in this case being SABS, and DTI being the department responsible for the designation policy. We're very much keen to avail the knowledge that we have of the industry to assist the overall process of verification, to take the industry to a point where we feel it's very competitive. So the details, once that is in place, then we start to deal with the details. Who does what? Remember, we know our members. We know who does bodies here. We know who does traction models, etc., etc. So once we have a packaged arrangement, we're then in a better position. Remember, we are aware of the fact that it's possible that most of the OEMs comply. They use our suppliers. But we don't have that kind of information. It's not verified. We always get reports from them. It's possible that they will say they cannot use our suppliers. So those are the things that we want to look at. But now we can only work on that once that package is in place. We agree. Did they agree? SABS agree. And then we avail the inners. In as far as your question, Honorable Mantashe, on did you ever give salaries, etc., not really, but I've mentioned here, I said we see local content as a critical developmental instrument for the inners. When you cannot provide market for the inners, it's difficult to enforce certain things. Now, if we implement the localization, for example, where like I always bring PRAS, I will bring Transnet, they will tell for this rolling stock project, we have X amount, and immediately I take it to the members and say, people, we have 10 billion rand to be spent on our local companies. And it means you must do something about skills development. It means you must support black industrialization. It means you need to do something about the enterprise development, all those things. But now we are at a point where there are no real data that we can make use of it. We always in between the suppliers and the OEMs, and it's difficult for the association to pronounce and say who is faulting within the years. So we have been very given about that, but we're very active in that space. We currently facilitating an exhibition for learners around Gauteng, because we want to understand that sometimes people understand rail as a high-level engineering type of sector. But now, if you talk of awareness, you go down, people can be train drivers, people can direct us to work on the overhead lines, you know. So we're working around there. And we're also working very close with the rail safety regulator, in trying to make sure that issues of standards, as I've shown you in that slide, they go up to where, because we've got unacceptable rates of derailment in South Africa, if you are to look at the way things are. So we're working around that, but we didn't really give, like, buzzers. But our members, it's them that you're supposed to tell them, you must do ABCD. But at this point in time, if you don't give market, you cannot really dictate to the members. Thank you.
Yes, thank you, Manufacturing Circle.
Madam Chair, if I may respond to both of the questions at the same time that were addressed to the Manufacturing Circle. Thereafter, defer to the DTI for their comment and input. The questions really center on one of the points that we made in the presentation, being that the objectives of the DTI and the procurement entities are not always aligned. And perhaps if I could just elaborate a little bit on that, that might clarify our position. The DTI is the custodian of local procurement as regulated in the Preferential Procurement Policy Framework Act. And there, those underlying objectives have to do with long-term industrialization and economic benefits of our country in terms of, what will take place by way of multiplier effect downstream and upstream benefits. Whereas if we look at the myriad of procurement entities which are supposed to comply with the PSA, the objectives, primary objectives can be different and for logical reasons. Department of Health, for example, is mandated to supply as much medication as it can at the cheapest price. ESCOM needs to deliver and transmit as much electricity as it can, for example. So at a basic level, the long-term objectives and local procurement objectives might not necessarily align on a short-term basis with what needs to be delivered from a procuring entity's point of view. So that is where the issue and the loopholes take place. The DTI has done its job in terms of mandating what needs to be designated. So the answer and the solution is perhaps not quite as easy, but it talks to this the requirement for public, private, and institutions to work together. And again, I use the SASIC, Southern African Institute of Steel Construction, as a very good example, where a lot of work is being done by the DTI in designating structural steel. SASIC has just informed me that there's been a request for two large steel construction bridges in the Eastern Cape region, and SASIC is working very closely with the procuring authority, being the South African National Roads Agency, to make it very clear to tenderers and bidders that there is this local consent requirement. So that's the kind of relationship and scenario that I am referring to. If I could, Madam Chair, just refer to the DTI for their specific comment.
Honourable Chair, thank you. I have 3.5 questions to respond to. Honourable Williams first. It's a fantastic question, because if only things were as simple as that. Honourable Williams, this is how it works. We identify tenders or bid notices in which there appears to be a lack of reference to local content. That is referred then to the DTI. Unfortunately, the DTI doesn't have the power to rescind tenders or to force a tendering authority to rescind a tender. And that really is the very large spanner in the process. The DTI, then, to our understanding, has to revert to a process of appeal and semi-threatening. So the appeal would be and semi-threatening. I mean, sort of a semi-sanction. The first one would be kindly withdraw and re-advertise. The second one would be to inform the tendering body that our recourse is to go to the AD if there is a problem here. And that's precisely why we've developed our response to open conversations, because the more people we load into a public conversation with the tendering body, the more pressure they feel to correct the actions. But certainly, if there is some ability to kind of remedy the DTI's ability to force changes or to have changes rescinded, or whether there is some way in which National Treasury is able to come quickly into that mix, that would be very useful. Honourable Mkongi, your question is also maybe difficult to answer. Obviously the thing about corruption generally is that unless it's found, it's not found. And it may be inferred, and if it exists, there may be signs of it. But to know beyond shadow of a doubt is very difficult. I mean, I think it would be public knowledge that that there is corruption in the tendering space. The very fact of having control over resources and being able to wield those resources gives the person who wields those resources some interest to some extent in doing them for other reasons. To our mind, there are two kinds of non-compliance with local content. The first one would be non-deliberate. So, in other words, it's born of ignorance, and if ignorance is too strong a word, then it's born of some mistakes. The second one would be that there is deliberate non-compliance with local content, and as I say, that is difficult to find. There have been instances which we've come across where there would appear to be question marks raised. So, for example, you know, there was a tender for there was a tender in one of the provinces at some stage for a product that was imported. It was imported at a higher price than it could be made locally. The irony. And eventually that issue blew up in the province, and I think the chief finance officer was suspended or fired as a result. So from those we can infer that there is possibly corruption which takes place. Certainly what we have found in some instances is an element of fraud. So for example, if we intervene in a tender, if we identify that a supplier has won a tender, an intermediary has won a tender, and we engage the intermediary, surprisingly they sometimes respond to us from their government address. It may be an employee in a government department, and of course the law then requires that that person has disclosed their interests before tendering, and when we check with the company or the director and ask, have you disclosed your interests, or is this something we should challenge? We then get the email to say, no, of course we've disclosed the interest, here's the proof, and they've only just disclosed the interest sort of minute after we've challenged them on it. So there must be examples in which that kind of fraud takes place too. Honourable Mantash, the regulations are concerned. We didn't include them in our presentation. You know, from our perspective, the DTI has the expertise. It's got the responsibility of manufacturing, and as far as we see it, we would like the responsibility of the DTI and its actions to grow in the face of local content rather than be diminished. But you know, we also recognize, and therefore we would want the active designation, responsibility of designation, to remain with the DTI. And we obviously recognize, though, that, you know, Treasury has lots of skills, and the best thing is for the departments to work closely and collaboratively together in a context where DTI remains the kind of controlling power in regulations. So those were the three questions, Honourable Chair, and I'll drop the half question.
Why? If I'm just checked with DTI, please, briefly.
Thanks, Madam Chair. If I may say so, I thought the agency is hugely important, and the process being adopted by SACRU is very helpful. I think that, you know, at the end of the day, we can get the best verification and compliance measures that are available on the planet in the room. At the end of the day, it's got to be about a collaborative effort between government and the private sector, which involves maximizing communication around tenders, ensuring compliance, blowing the whistle on non-compliance. But at the end of the day, it's a collaborative effort between the state and the private sector to increase aggregate demand and grow our manufacturing sectors. Clothing and textiles, because it's labor intensive, is particularly important. Rail, because it's a big industrial sector where there's technology, there's massive spillovers, there's enormous opportunities for exports and so on and so forth. So I thought that the SACRU approach was absolutely spot on. You know, at the end of the day, procurement is a constitutional function of the National Treasury, and we must accept and appreciate and respect that. But from the perspective of the Department of Trade and Industry, the localization element, procurement is probably the strongest tool that we have in the industrial policy toolbox. I said at the beginning, Minister Davies has been quite clear, there's lots of hypocrisy in this space. The OECD countries, you just have to look at the Buy America Act. They use public procurement as a massively powerful tool for industrialization. Whether it's the arms industry in the US or the public works programs in the Buy America Act, we've got to give this public procurement instrument the urgency it deserves, which means getting the right legislation and regulation in place ensuring that the National Treasury and the BTR work very closely together, and that agency in civil society is hugely important, of the kind that we've heard from SACTU. You know, the points that are made by the manufacturing circle, some I agree with, others I don't. The one that I do agree with is competition. It can't be that if there's not more than one local company, that localization doesn't apply. The National Treasury can simply use a reference pricing system to say, as long as you are cost competitive, price competitive, meet the required standards and specifications, we've got to support you. In fact, the big successful industrializers identified their national champions and gave them massive support, including through the procurement instrument. And, you know, one just has to look at South Korea as a very good example of that. I do say, and I say this with respect, and I said it the other day, it's very important for the private sector to get into a collaborative arrangement with the public sector and maximize the use of the procurement instrument to support manufacturing and industrialization. But it's problematic when large industrial companies, including, if I may say so with the utmost respect, who are members of the manufacturing circle, and they push government for localization, but they themselves in their supply chains and procurement are importers. And this applies sometimes to manufacturing companies who import, and so they're both importers and manufacturers. And so we've got to get into the room on this matter. The private sector has signed the procurement accord, but frankly speaking, there's very little traction in this regard. And I think we need to find a way of working together on this matter. That means ramping up Proudly South Africa and big national campaigns to buy local, amongst other issues. And we are in the process, which we can talk about in another session, Madam Chair, in the process of strengthening Proudly South Africa at a whole lot of different levels. With respect to the South African Railroad Association, you know, the colleague makes a presentation as if to suggest we aren't cooperating. We are absolutely cooperating. If there's a specific issue around which we need stronger cooperation, whether it's with Transnet or SAS on verification or the OEMs, let's hear the concrete proposal rather than just this mantra that we need to be cooperating, because we are cooperating. And if I may say so with utmost respect, the Export Council responsibilities which lie with the South African Railroad Association, I think there should be an emphasis on that and their members, because we can help there with respect to export promotion into Africa. And by the way, it's a mistake to say that South African companies aren't already exporting to the African continent. They are. You just have to look at Grindrod Rail to understand that they are. And so I think we've got to focus the discussion on what's pragmatic, what's possible, what's doable, and build on the successes, perhaps rather than throwing stones at each other. Thank you.
No, thank you very much. But thank you to the Railroad Association, Manufacturer Circle, and SACTU. Thank you very much. Did you want to do a quick follow-up? Right, directors?
Well, I'm not sure they're closing the session because I just wanted to throw some things and then that they must not be used in between. Yeah, but Chairperson, I wanted to raise two things that have been raised by the DTI, which maybe we have been making an oversight since they presented at the beginning of this year or last year. That we must resuscitate the question of the export tax on scrap metal. I think they are raising that very sharply. So it must not... The second thing that they are going up and out is the question of the environmental laws that affect the efforts of industrialization, particularly on the question of the demise of the foundry in South Africa. We must resuscitate those things and make sure that when we take resolutions, we hit hard on them. Thank you very much.
To the committee, back to the committee, Honourable Montage.
Mine is not a question, it's just a concern that I've observed that when RRA was winding up responses, he made a good statement that they have made an exhibition for engineers in housing. And I appreciate that, but I would love to ask a question whether that would be their last exhibition and they're not extending that exhibition to other provinces. Because our provinces also need those engineers. They need to be told, you know, that this profession is open to all of you, not only people from a certain area. Because if you do that, we'll be repeating what their party regime did to ensure that a small group of people has access to certain professions.
I think that is also important. You know, I come from Gauteng, and we do have to get the lion's share of everything. And it is important, of course, to try and ensure we can, in some way, bring in other provinces. It may not be possible to do it in 9 provinces all at one time, but, you know, perhaps at least in 4 where it's easier for people to gather. Thank you very much, though, for that point, and perhaps we can communicate by email on that particular point. Now, before you move, anyone, I would also like, I'm not sure both China South and China North Rail are here, but I know one of them are at least. Are you both here? Both. Right. Because I wasn't there for your presentation, but what I did become aware of during the questioning and some of the statements is the issue around verification, you remember, which was reiterated. Now, we have had this clear statement from National Treasury. And I think it's clear that the matter is going further. However, you see in South Africa, a South African company as such would not be allowed to simply say, we won't do this until you do that. And I think that that is the wrong approach to the matter. And I would earnestly appeal to you, China South and China North. You've heard what the engagements today, you've heard National Treasury, you've heard DTI and other presenters, and it is clear, nobody is saying, I refuse to do this until, but rather, let's see how we can work together, and this is a serious challenge. Of course, for anyone tendering, it would be quite useful to know how much of the cost you have to bear. Yes, I think that's important to any in business. But let's rather work together. I see that EDG is talking about a collaborative approach, the Rail Association about a cooperative approach, you know, working together, manufacturing circle is saying let's do this together, and the unions are saying much the same thing. But I would suggest that if I look at this union one, and it just happened to be the top one now, look at this. They've made some very clear proposals regarding these issues. And we would ask China South and North, please come back to us with perhaps a page or two indicating your proposals around this, because you heard the problem, or what? You heard people saying, we haven't got the solution. We haven't got the solution. What did come up in the committee, either last year or early this year, was that we can't have the same approach to co-ops and small business as we would to the larger corporates. There has to be some difference, you know, and I don't think anyone would disagree on that. Should the Anglos of this world and a co-op be paying the same? So we maybe even need a form of exemption where National Treasury bears the cost of co-ops or whatever. I'm saying this may be the solution. But we haven't taken decisions, and these are things we would want to hear about and think about. But China is
a very industrialized country, very big market, a huge economy, and no doubt you have got some proposals that have worked in your own country, which you may wish to share with us. So I really would appreciate that, the whole committee would. Of course, we want to thank everyone present here, because we are very serious about this. The intention is not to collapse the economy, of course not, but to rather try and grow the economy together. We will be preparing a report, and you would be invited to be here when we are discussing this. You may all want to send at least one person and, you know, hear what the committee has distilled from the colloquium itself, and still make a small contribution before it goes out as far as the AGC. And we do need your help. We do. We're asking you to give it to us very clearly. But I'm not sure why transport wasn't here today, the department, and public enterprises. I did hear they had a challenge, but I'm not aware of the challenge itself. But we will try to get them here when we do the report side of it, so they're also here at the time. But this is important. It was too short a time, I'm sure, but we don't have a choice. I also apologize as chair for the small group you've got here of the committee, but I've already explained one member is sick and others just been redeployed, you know, and others are following up on election celebrations, and that's beyond my control. I'm sure we'll all be back to normal and very routine. I can't see who's holding a hand up, but I'm not even sure from where you come, so if you could introduce yourself.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Khoma Zomdisi. I'm from the Department of Public Enterprises.
May not have been told by Mr. Whittington, but this side is for journalists, MPs and staff, you see. So that's probably why I didn't realise you were here. But thank you. Do you wish to make any comments?
I just wanted to get clarification on the chair statement around challenges with DPE. If it was with regard to attendance, then I'm fine.
It is with regard to attendance. At the time this, we set the date, it was still not clear whether you would be able to attend. That's why I was looking out for you. Thank you. Not with anything else. Is there anyone else at transport that we've overlooked? The department? No. On that note, you'll be very pleased that although we indicated 13:30, I imagine it's 1:10. Is that the situation? 1:14. So we've kept on track. I want to thank the members of staff for all the work they've put in, and also the presenters for your presentations and your assistance in helping us to carry out more effective oversight. I may say we do oversight FITE visits as well. So if you think that what we have come out here, it would help the committee if they visited X, you hear what I'm saying? Then put that forward to us in an email. Be a good idea if the committee went X, you know, and had an on the site. Because as you know, that word oversight is what we do. We exercise monitoring oversight. There's another understanding that this was an oversight, that you've forgotten something. And then the site visit. So it's a site visit, a locality which we are interested in looking at. We may not do it this year, but we could do it the following year itself. On that note, we'd like to adjourn the colloquium and indicate that our committees begin next week on Tuesday. The time has been changed from 9:00 Tuesday to 10:00 Tuesday. Is everyone aware of that? Yes, well, there we are. I understand Mr. Hamza had informed you. Secondly,